Welcome to the Shame-Free Zone with Veronica Monet, your friendly former sex worker and certified sexologist. The Shame-Free Zone is a safe place for your questions and your secrets about all things sexual.
Hey, thanks for tuning in. This is Veronica Monet, the Shame-Free Zone. And we're going to pick up where we left off last week. I was telling you a little bit about me because now since June I've been interviewing people. And, you know, we've got to cover a lot of really interesting, intriguing topics. But one thing that has been frustrating me a little bit is I just haven't had a chance to tell you, my listeners, much about me. And it's my hope that if I show you mine, you'll show me yours. So maybe you can call up and tell me something about yourself, if you feel like it. If not, you can just feel free to listen in. So last week I pretty much left off at the point where my husband had become convinced that it was okay to be married to a prostitute. And if you will recall, I convinced him of this by inviting him to pay for my services. And his eyes had lit up, and it became apparent to me that he thought that as a prostitute, I was holding out on him somehow. I was giving all the good stuff to the guys who were paying me, and that he, my husband, was getting leftovers. And nothing could have been further from the truth, and that became readily apparent to him, and then he decided that he didn't want to be one of my clients. He'd much rather be my husband, and we pretty much sailed off into the sunset on that one. Now, as far as that particular point goes, it's true. We came to an understanding, and he didn't give me any kind of heartache about my profession ever again. And we were married for 12 years, together for 13, and we've been divorced now for 4. We're still very good friends and sometimes lovers, and I know all that can be a little bit controversial for this serial monogamous society, but I'm actually a little more poly than that. So I have other friends in my life, but I've retained a very close friendship with my ex-husband. As a matter of fact, we are getting ready to film a documentary, which is going to air on the Women's Entertainment Network at the first part of 2009. We're going to be filming the documentary this week, starting this week and into next week. So it's a big deal. I'm going to be shooting a total of about 3 days for this documentary. And it's being produced through Blue Chip Films. And we are one of the people that's being profiled. Now, the topic of this documentary is domestic violence. And we have a very interesting story about that. And we're hoping that we will be able to enlighten and educate people about what we consider an incredibly important topic, but a very misunderstood one. Now, let's backtrack a little bit, and I'll tell you a little bit about my background. I grew up in a home where both my parents were very dysfunctional people, and my father was abusive towards my mother. And my mother was also an abusive person. However, because she was, you know, smaller and weaker than my dad, oftentimes she's the one who got hurt, and my father very rarely got hurt. You know, he tended to win those arguments. But my mother found ways to be violent to us kids as a way to, you know, kind of get that out of her system. And this is not uncommon. What you'll find in homes where there is violence is a lot of times the most abusive person takes it out on the less powerful person, who then takes it out on the less powerful person, and takes it out on the less powerful person until you get to the family dog. And I may sound like I'm a little flip on this topic. I'm not, but, you know, that's kind of the joke. If you've seen, you know, the guy's had a bad day at the office, and his boss gives him a hard time, so he comes home and yells at his wife. And anyway, it all translates to somehow or another landing at the feet of the family pet. in our family, there was never any acknowledgement that this was a problem. You know, I grew up in the 70s, and we were just starting to kind of get a dialogue about this, and people still really functioned in this very dysfunctional, violent way, and thought that it was okay. So parents were still into spanking their kids, and the movies were still replete with lots of examples of boyfriends and girlfriends and husbands and wives slapping each other, and that was considered okay. Now, you would get slapped with a lawsuit or a restraining order. So things have changed quite a bit, and I am happy to say that I was part of that change. One of the things that I got involved in early on was the domestic violence movement. So when I left home, I went to college, went to Oregon State University, got a degree in psychology, and I was trained as a volunteer for a center against rape and domestic violence in Corvallis, Oregon. And this was very extensive training. We were being instructed for like a full month. And we had this huge book we had to work through, and it was, you know, they were very, very particular about who was going to pass, because we were going to be working with real incest survivors, real rape survivors, and real battered women. And as volunteers, we wore pagers. They would notify us when somebody was coming into the shelter, and you'd have to get up whatever time of day it was or time of night, and get down to the shelter and, you know, hold this person's hand and try to get them through the intake process and hopefully to the next step, which is usually a restraining order and whatnot. And the shelter's location was secret. You know, we were always concerned about angry partners coming and to hurt not only their partner but, you know, possibly hurt the staff. And it wasn't unheard of, course, and it still isn't, unfortunately, unheard of, that in domestic violence situations, sometimes murder is committed. So this was a volunteer position that was pretty high risk. And we were beginning a dialogue around the topic of incest as well. This was not a word that people were throwing around in the media at all in 1982, which was the year that I was volunteering for the Center Against Rape and Domestic Violence. People were not talking about date rape. Nobody even knew what that was. And very few people said the word incest. That was considered very taboo, and it certainly wasn't a topic for public discourse. So these were exciting times. We had just started having the Take Back the Night marches. We would march down the streets, and you know, we'd be yelling, "Take back the night," and the whole idea about the Take Back the Night marches, that we wanted women to feel safe to walk the streets any time of day without fear of being raped. And sometimes the boys in the fraternities would be, you know, their heads hanging out the windows of their fraternities. They'd be yelling at us about how they wanted to rape us. So it was kind of a hostile time for women's rights, and I think I'm being kind of putting that mildly, it was actually a pretty hostile time for women's rights. So 1982, and I got training in that, and then I went on to get into an abusive relationship. And the thing about domestic violence is that, you know, mostly, even now, I mean, 1982 to 2008, that's quite a span of time, and what we basically have got at this point is a belief that domestic violence is something that men do to women. Now, the police officers who go out to intervene on domestic violence cases are becoming more and more acquainted with the fact that oftentimes there is violence being perpetrated by two partners, but oftentimes that is still a difficult concept to try to communicate to the public, and it's a difficult thing for women to buy into. A lot of times if she hits her partner, she may feel justified because he hit her first, or there's just kind of still this mythology that somehow or another men are not as easily hurt. I know that some of the resources that are out there won't even entertain the idea that men can be battered. There's next to know. I mean, there's like maybe a couple of resources in the nation that will actually talk to men about being battered by a woman. And there are no shelters for men. So if a man is battered, he has no place to go. And this documentary that my ex-husband and I are getting ready to do is going to be talking about men who get battered. And it's interesting because they're going to be profiling a police officer and a weightlifter and a guy who's in the Marines. Now, this is kind of a difficult thing for people to wrap their minds around. Maybe not everybody. I think some people, you know, are living it, so it's not so difficult for them to understand. But for a lot of people, this is still a really foreign concept, so we hope to educate people about that. And this is how our story goes. Basically, we fell in love very early on, in 1982. We're both working in a telecommunications company. And it was the 80s, and cocaine was a really popular drug, and we were both doing way more than our share of it. And cocaine has a tendency to exacerbate whatever character defects or emotional problems you might have, and we became a couple of very angry, violent people. And the relationship degraded to one where it seemed like every other weekend we were calling the cops for some reason. Either one of us had OD'd or there was domestic violence or something of that nature. So the cops were at our door a lot. And this was a very, very scary time. And it's one of the reasons, one of the reasons, not the whole reason, but one of the reasons, a very strong incentive for me to get clean and sober in 12-step, which, as I shared with you last week, was a really important time in my life. But this was the part of the story that I left out. And the reason I left it out is because I think it needs to be told by itself. It's a difficult one. At the time that I eventually extricated myself from this relationship, I was very much of the mind that because I was the woman, I was an innocent player. That he was a bad man who was breaking all the rules by hitting a woman, and I needed help, and that was it. You know, I needed help getting away from him, and I needed to learn to pick different men. There was a book out at the time too, Women Who Love Too Much. Can't remember the name of the author, but that was a very popular book, and it was all about women who were just too loving, too trusting, too sweet, too kind, and we just had this tendency to pick all these really terrible boys, these bad, bad men. As a matter of fact, the author of the book recommended that for those of us who had really messed up and made some bad choices in mates, that from now on we should always go out with a guy that we were not sexually attracted to. So the premise was that we probably were only attracted to men who were bad for us. And I actually tried that for a while. It was horrible. It was really horrible. And eventually decided that really wasn't for me. But I went through all kinds of things. There were groups. Domestic Violence Anonymous has these groups where you can go to, and almost all the people who go there are women, and they don't allow any perpetrators in there. And again, you know, I want to talk about these words. We have basically perpetrators and victims. And sometimes people use the word survivor instead of victim. Now, a victim is basically somebody who's absolutely not empowered to have any control over their life at all. So we like the word survivor better. Survivor acknowledges the tenacity, perseverance, courage that it has taken in order to survive a really traumatic event. And that's something you can build on. You can build upon those strengths so that you can hopefully recover and become a stronger, more well-balanced human being. The idea of perpetrator is one that we apply towards anybody who's committed a grievous act on another human being, you know, whether it's rape or assault, domestic violence, incest. Those are perpetrators. because of the way our culture has got a really black and white attitude towards right and wrong, the good guys and the bad guys, and you would think we might have outgrown this, but we're still really stuck in this idea of us versus them, right versus wrong, good versus evil. And, I mean, all you really have to do is listen to politicians to see what lurks in our subconscious, because those are the buttons that they want to push in order to get us to vote for them. So, you know, when you've got a politician talking about the evildoers, this is a polarizing concept which gets us basically out of the idea of looking at ourselves and seeing what kind of responsibilities we might have for the things we're bringing into our lives. And we get to demonize the other. We get to look at other people as being the problem. So anyway, I'm pretty much on board for this whole concept in the early 80s, and I think that I've figured out that I just need to pick better men from now on, and I go on to live a sober life, and I did. I picked men that weren't going to treat me that way, or at least that's what it seemed like to me. And whenever it seemed to me that somebody might have a problem with their temper, I just eliminated them from my life. Now, the thing I never got a chance to look at was my own temper and my own violence. And keep in mind, I came from a violent home. I came from a violent home, so I had learned a lot of nasty habits. But if you don't stay in a long-term relationship with somebody, and if you're not married to them, it can become pretty easy to convince yourself that you don't have any problems. And there's some interesting things that happen once you say, I do. A lot of times people will be able to be in a relationship for an extended period of time without any complications, and then they say, I do. They go through the marriage ceremony, and everything changes. And this is exactly what happened for my husband and I. When we got married and said, I do, we had already been living together for an entire year. And during that year, we had not had any problems of any kind. It was very peaceful and loving and sweet, and sure, we had some arguments, but nothing ever got scary or out of hand in any way, shape, or form. Then we had our beautiful wedding ceremony in Yosemite, and we came home and basically turned into people other than ourselves. I became my mother, he became his father, and all of a sudden, we were sharing this marriage with our predecessors. And that was really disconcerting, and it got worse than concerning. It got very scary. At the first sign that things might get physically abusive, I knew this was something that I needed to take, very strict measures against. So I immediately changed the locks, got a restraining order, and insisted that he get help. And he did. He went through a program called Men Overcoming Violence. And this is an amazing, wonderful program. But there was nothing like that for women. And, of course, at this point, I really didn't think I had a problem, didn't think I needed any kind of help. And after he completed that program for about a year and a half, and we were completely separated, he lived in a different location, and I lived at home, and now I want you to keep in mind, this in itself was a very revolutionary concept. The idea that I shouldn't just divorce him and never speak to him again, but that he might be able to get help and be a good husband was not, at this time, this was like 1992, this was not a concept that was very popular. There was a lot being said at the time that any man who's ever hit a woman will never be able to change. And that was and still is for some people, the party line, which is basically that change is possible for these kind of men. They have a severe problem, and we should just throw them in jail and lock them up forever. So we found this program called Men Overcoming Violence, where there was actually hope that men could move past this really destructive behavior pattern. And at the time, the focus is very much on this is a male problem. So I'm looking for the traditional type of resources at this time. I went back to Domestic Violence Anonymous and started seeing a therapist, and, you know, basically had a lot of sympathy for what I was being put through by this horrible man I just married. And as he started to change, as he started to become a nonviolent person, it shifted the dynamic in our relationship. And the first thing that I noticed was that I had a real problem with him being nonviolent. I actually felt like he was something of a wuss. It was like, well, this guy doesn't have any guts. He doesn't have the characteristics that I associate with masculinity. So that was a newsflash for me. I thought that if he changed, I'd be thrilled. But instead, all of a sudden, I realized that I was going to have to start changing and start working on me. So I started looking around for programs that might help me change my own behavior. And at this point, I really don't think I'm physically abusive, but I know that I'm verbally abusive. I'm yelling and name-calling and screaming. My entire concept of what it means to be violent is shifting, too, because of the information that my husband is bringing into the relationship. So it turns out that blocking your partner, like if your partner tries to leave the room to get away from you, and if you stand in between them and the door and insist that they have this conversation with you when they don't want to have a conversation with you, that's a form of violence. Slamming doors is a form of violence. Raising your voice, calling somebody a name, blackmailing them, threatening to do something to them or something that they love, these are all forms of violence. I had no idea. I thought violence was about, you know, raising your hand to strike another human being. Not so. So this was really kind of messing with my reality, and now I was starting to realize that I really wasn't as nonviolent a person as I had thought I was. Now, what was really upsetting to me was I really couldn't find any resources like Men Overcoming Violence for women. I ended up finding one domestic violence group in San Francisco for women who were abusive to their partners. And I started going to this meeting, and it was almost all lesbians. And almost all of them were doing really horrific things to their girlfriends. You know, like one talked about holding her girlfriend over the balcony by her ankles and threatening to drop her. And another girlfriend had held her girl with a knife to her throat. I mean, these were like some really violent women. But they were not sorry about their behavior. Here they were going to groups ostensibly to change their behavior, but they spent the whole time just sitting around laughing about what kind of, you know, badasses they were. And the more I watched this and I realized that I really wasn't getting a lot of recovery out of this, what was happening for me was that I was kind of identifying with them. It was like, damn straight, you know, I'm a tough girl too. And not that I had ever done anything like that, but still, I liked the whole idea of thinking of myself as a tough girl. And I thought about the movie Thelma and Louise, which was pretty popular at this time. And if you haven't seen it, it's Susan Sarandon and I can't remember the other actress's name, but anyway, these two girls who just, they've had it. They're abusive boyfriends and abusive husbands and this guy that tries to date rape them, and they just kind of blow a fuse. And they go on a spree, and mostly they just kill like one guy is all. And then they rob some places, and they got a gun, and they're shooting up all kinds of things. And it's kind of like they're getting back at all these men that have made life miserable for women. And a lot of women were running around with T-shirts for this movie. And I know I loved watching the movie. So it was kind of this attitude of it's our turn to get even. And I really encountered a lot of this when I was going into these groups where women were supposed to be trying to stop being violent, but really they were just sitting around bragging about how violent they were. I think in a lot of ways our culture is still heading in that direction, where we are seeing young girls are joining gangs, and they're starting to do a lot of street fighting, and there is this attitude that we have finally become more like men. And I really don't have any problem with men becoming more like women and women becoming more like men. I could care less. But anything which holds violence out as an ideal that we want to aspire to, that I have a problem with, regardless of what your gender is. So anyway, I ended up having to ask my ex-husband, at the time he was my husband, I had to ask him to help me to, I actually asked him to sponsor me, to teach me what he had learned in men overcoming violence so that I could get the information, because it wasn't being offered anywhere to women. And this is really what I see as a glaring problem at this point, which is that, you know, when I think back to that domestic violence shelter where we were coming to the rescue of these women and their children, and yet one of the things we never looked at was how families are usually violent. It's not usually just a person. The whole family culture is violent, and this becomes something that the mothers are doing to their children. You know, like I said, basically it's throughout the entire fabric of the family. So if you just treat one person or you just remove one person, that doesn't mean that you're going to stop having violence. And when I think about the fact that a lot of times we just assume that the mother doesn't have a problem and we put the kids with her because somehow or another being female makes her safe and right, and so we don't have to worry that the kids are going to get abused, I think that's really negligent. And I hope that with this documentary, we will be able to start bringing some of this out of the closet. In the past, it's been kind of taboo for men to even admit that they are afraid of their female partners. And certainly, like I said, women have actually kind of felt entitled to being oppressive because somehow or another, you know, we feel like it's our turn, or we're just trying to stand up for ourselves. We feel justified. And let me tell you something, there is nothing more dangerous on this planet than a victim. Remember when I was talking about perpetrators and victims? If you actually think that you're a victim, you're a very dangerous person. If you go to death row, everybody there is a victim. Everybody there got a rotten deal, somehow or another, you know, got taken advantage of, couldn't help themselves, you know, everything was against them, blah, blah, blah. So I see a female pattern, and I certainly saw it in myself and then in the support groups that I went to, of basically that we're victims so we can do no wrong. And anyway, so I'm not going to tell the whole story tonight because I want to spend the other half hour answering some of the questions that people have been bringing to me. But there's a little bit more of my story of why it is that I work with people around anger management. I have quite a few tools, and they're hard-won tools that I have learned in the trenches, in real life, not in a textbook. Well, okay, there was textbooks too, but the part that really counts, I think, is actually living through it, because then you're able to help people kind of understand some of the stages and the feelings that come up. And if you're interested, be watching for the episode on domestic violence. It's going to be coming out on the Women's Entertainment Network. That's a cable channel just for women, but certainly I hope the men will tune in too. I'm not sure when it's going to air. We're filming it this week and next. I would imagine it won't air until sometime in January. Look for the episode on domestic violence, and the name of the show is The Secret Lives of Women. Secret Lives of Women. Okay, so, and there you'll find out more details about that story, which is also going to be in my memoirs, which my agent is shopping as we speak. So let's get to a question here. And by the way, if you would like to call in with your own questions or comments, feel free. This is a live show, and the call-in number for the United States is 877-876-5227. That's 877-876-5227. If you're in Canada, you can call 888-815-9756. That's 888-815-9756. Now, last week we talked a little bit about the I'm horny, but I want to go to heaven. Please help. And if you didn't tune in for that, feel free to look up the archives. We have the files there. They're really easy to get into and a lot of fun. And that was last Monday, the 17th. So tonight we're going to talk about premature ejaculation, and I'm also going to talk some about erectile dysfunction. So I'm suffering from premature ejaculation. Please, can you help me get rid of this problem? How can I satisfy a woman sexually? Now, I'm also going to talk about erectile dysfunction, ED, as it's known for short, and I'm sure how many of us have heard the advertisements for Viagra and Cialis, which are meant to treat erectile dysfunction. So this whole thing, first of all, our culture's gotten really obsessed with the function of penises. So first thing I want to say is, you know, you can have some amazing sex without an erection. As a matter of fact, you can have some amazing sex without genitals, period. And, you know, if you're interested, I teach people how to have orgasms without genitals, and you can learn about it from me, or you can research it online. Tantra is where you want to start with that. Tantra is an amazing way to have orgasms, and you do not need genitals to do it. And there's a lot of people out there who are differently abled and not able to access certain parts of their anatomy, and they have very full, exciting, wonderful, fulfilling sex lives. So first of all, let's just get away from that whole idea that somehow or another you have to have an erect penis to get to great sex, because you don't. And, you know, this is not lost on the lesbian couples out there who know that they don't need an erect penis either. And I'm not saying that you just substitute with a dildo. I'm actually saying you don't need penetration. But let's say you do want to have penetration, and you don't want to use a dildo, and you want to use a penis. Okay. So let's talk about all the things that make a penis function the way we'd like it to function. First of all, when it comes to getting an erection, you need to have good health, and in particular, you need to have a good circulation. So blood flow. Penis is all about blood flow. If you're not getting the blood to your penis, it's not going to get erect. And if you can't sustain an erection, you know, there's some other things that you can look at too. But let's look at some of the health things that you'd want to eliminate. First and foremost, if you've got any problems with your penis at all, you do want to get it to a doctor and get your prostate examined. You know, if you have any problems with your prostate, it can cause problems with the functioning of the penis. And that's a real important thing. The other thing, you want to look at whether or not you might have problems with diabetes. So I would recommend a blood sugar test as well, so you can eliminate diabetes as a possible complication. Diabetes reduces circulation to all your extremities, so you might not have as much blood flow to your hands and your feet, and this is why a lot of times we hear about people undergoing amputations as they age with diabetes because of the lack of circulation to these extremities. So it's a potentially a very, very, very serious problem, and that's why, you know, when it comes to type 2 diabetes, you don't want to take that lightly, and type 2 diabetes is not something you're born with. That's something you give yourself by really poor eating habits. So, you know, you want to stay away from the sugar and minimize the carbohydrates as much as possible and try to eat a diet of fresh fruits and vegetables and lean meats. That really is the best way to go. But anyway, I'm not a nutritionist, so I'm not going to try to get into that territory. I would just say be sure and check with your doctor about diabetes and prostate complications. Now, if you get a clean bill of health, there's still things that you can be doing to your health that would cause your penis to function in a way that's substandard. One, if you smoke. Smoking is going to reduce the ability of your body to push blood into the penis. Now, this doesn't happen to everybody. There's plenty of smokers out there that have rock-hard cocks, and you might be one of them, and if that's the case, then you got nothing to worry about except for lung cancer. But if you are a smoker and you are having problems, the first thing I would do is say quit smoking and see what happens to your penis. I would imagine that you would find that it works a lot better. The other thing that you want to look into is obesity. If you carry a lot of fat on your frame, one of the things that excess fat does is fat cells produce estrogen. And estrogen is not exactly a hormone that's real conducive to rock-hard erections. Estrogen is what grows babies. Estrogen is more feminine. And although all of us, both male and female and transgender, all of us have a cocktail of testosterone, progesterone, and estrogen, and the only thing that makes us different hormonally as far as gender goes is that cocktail is arranged differently. So if you're a man, you have more testosterone, less estrogen and progesterone, and if you're a woman, it's just the reverse. You've got more estrogen and progesterone and less testosterone. But all sexual desire is fueled by testosterone. And if you're a woman who has less sexual desire, they're not going to give you an estrogen patch. They're going to give you a testosterone patch. So if you're a man who's having any kind of sexual difficulties at all, you may want to try to lose weight if you think you've gotten a little heavy, because it could be creating a little too much of the wrong hormone. Okay, so we got diabetes as a possible complication, prostate as a possible complication, smoking, drinking. Okay, if you drink too much alcohol, again, this doesn't affect everybody in the same way, but for a lot of people, alcohol is a depressant, which can reduce one's ability to function sexually, but it also is another thing that can work against your health and the circulation of blood. So here's what happens to a lot of guys. They will get drunk when they're out on a date, and it puts them in the mood because alcohol reduces your inhibitions and, you know, makes you more sociable and more carefree, so you're more likely to try to engage in sex, and then once you get there, you're not able to show up for it in the way you were hoping. So I work with a lot of men who find that alcohol really does have a deleterious effect on their sexual function. And like I said, it doesn't affect everybody, but I strongly recommend if you are having a problem, try not drinking and see what happens. So, you know, again, yes, you can go get a blue pill. But keep in mind, the blue pill puts a real strain on your heart. Viagra doesn't come without side effects. That's why it's a prescribed medication. And although a lot of people are now taking Viagra like it's some kind of experimental drug, it's, you know, there's young men in their 20s that are taking Viagra now just because in our culture, more is always better. So they don't even have a problem with erectile dysfunction, but they want to take Viagra because, you know, the same reason they want to do a hit of ecstasy. So, I don't recommend that. Not as a sexologist. I recommend you leave the drugs alone and try to work on your health. Here's another thing that can really boost your sexual function. Exercise. Exercise boosts testosterone. It's also a really great way to increase your circulation and your body's ability to function under stress. And, you know, sex is very pleasurable, but it's also stressful. It causes you to breathe heavy and your heart pumps harder. So exercise is going to be a good thing for sex. And finally, if you are on any kind of antidepressants, almost every single antidepressant on the market right now has some kind of a suppressive effect on sex drive and sexual function. Now, it takes a lot of forms. Sometimes the man will not be able to get his penis erect. Sometimes there will be less sexual desire. Sometimes there will be lots of desire and a very erect penis, but an inability to have an orgasm. So you could just have sex all night and never get to that point to where you'd have an orgasm, and that can be very frustrating for some people. Other people might feel very proud of their ability not to come. You know, again, we're all very diverse, and there's a lot of different ways to to find satisfaction through sex. So depending on how you like your sex, you may or may not enjoy that. But most people who get prescribed antidepressants are at some point going to feel a little frustration around the sexual department, and your doctor knows this very well and has fielded those kind of questions over and over again. Now, most medical doctors are not going to be able to tell you much about how to improve your sex life, but they will work with you as far as changing the type of antidepressant you're on, or perhaps the dosage, so that you can, you know, try to mollify the effects that it might be having on your ability to either achieve an erection or an ejaculation. So once you've covered all of these health concerns, and there's a very extensive list, as you've just been witness to, once you've covered all of those, the next thing is, if you don't have any health problems and none of these things are an issue for you, I ask men to take note of the difference between their sexual function when they are by themselves masturbating and when they are in a relationship with another human being. Because 9 times out of 10, and that's not an actual statistic, that's just one that I pulled out of my hat, what I usually hear is that, no, I have complete sexual function when I masturbate. I get an erection, I'm able to orgasm, it's wonderful. It's just when I'm having sex with a person that I have problems. And this is really, really common, and what it really points to is the fact that a lot of times our genitals are much more shy than we are. So sometimes we put ourselves in situations where we're very anxious to have sex, and we can't wait, and we're really excited about it, but our genitals, what be us male or female, women don't notice it as much. Men, you know, because of their anatomy, tend to feel a lot more pressure to perform. But either gender can feel very shy and find that their body is not working the way they had hoped that it would work. So women might find that they don't get lubricated as much as they thought they would, even though they were very excited, the lubrication's just not there. Or they may find that they just aren't able to experience an orgasm. And with men, it can come down to not being able to sustain an erection. Like, they may get an erection right at the beginning of the sex act, and then as they get ready to penetrate, they'll lose their erection, or they'll lose their erection halfway through. Or they'll be able to sustain an erection the entire time they're having sex, but they won't be able to experience an orgasm. If you're not having any of these difficulties when you masturbate, and you've already eliminated all of these other health complications, if your functioning when you're having sex with another human being is different than when you're having sex with yourself, you can pretty much bet that whatever's happening when you have sex with other people is about your emotions. It's about your head. It's what's going on between your ears, not between your legs. And this is the area where I spend most of my time actually helping people. Because, you know, people would like to know that it was something quick and easy where you can just work on taking a pill or doing something for your health, and then it's all over with. And, you know, we're just more complicated than that. When it comes to sex, people are very much wrapped up with their emotions and their feelings and what they're thinking. And sometimes it's as simple as, anxiety, performance anxiety. Sometimes men are just afraid. They're just afraid, like, oh, I'm afraid I'll come too soon, or I'm afraid, you know, that I won't be big enough or hard enough, or I'm afraid that I won't do it right. And that kind of fear can make a guy really nervous, and it can make it very difficult to stay focused on just letting go. The other thing that happens is if people get really focused on trying to control things. They want everything to be just right, and they're trying very much to control themselves. And a lot of women will worry about, you know, their facial expressions, or if they're sweating too much, or, is my hair messed up? And with men, sometimes, you know, they're concerned about whether or not she's having a good time, and, that kind of activity up in your brain really takes away from the activity in your genitals. If you're way up in your head, it's kind of hard to let go. And sex is all about letting go. It really is. So I recommend something that's, you know, probably going to sound a little strange, but I recommend meditation. Meditation and conscious breathing exercises for people who are having anxiety around sex. This is a great way to learn how to let go in a non-sexual context, and then you can transfer that skill to the sexual arena. But, you know, if you are very much focused on having control in that moment, it's going to be very difficult to let go. Orgasms are all about letting go. I like to think about orgasms as like, it's really like falling off the cliff. You know, you can't hang on. You've got to just completely let go and not worry about where it's going to take you. And if you are holding your breath, which some people do when they come, you might still be able to achieve an orgasm, but it's going to be a fraction of what you're capable of. So you really want to learn how to breathe into those orgasms and allow them to become expansive. Some of the things that happen with premature ejaculation, this is often either extreme nervousness or sometimes it's a fear of intimacy. You know, you might be afraid of getting close to this person and you want to hurry up and get the sex act over as quickly as possible. This sounds really counterintuitive. You might have spent weeks, months, years trying to get this person into bed, I don't know. And then you get there and all of a sudden what strikes you is the fear that you're going to get too close to them and somehow or another they're going to swallow you up or control you or take over your life. And so then, you know, the quickest way you can have sex and get out of there becomes what happens. These are not things that we plan out and want to happen. It's just what happens because we're fearful. Most of us are very, very vulnerable. And when it comes to sex, you can't get much more vulnerable. So these things are not uncommon. It happens to lots of people. And one of the first things you have to do is stop trying so hard. Now, when I was an escort, I would get clients who came in and they were so worried about not being able to get an erection, not being able to ejaculate, not being able to come. This was a really huge thing that came up over and over again. Excuse me, pun intended, I guess. And one of the games that I used to play with them is I'd say, okay, what I want you to do is try not to have an orgasm. And immediately, of course, they'd laugh because they just paid for an orgasm. And here I was telling them, try not to. And it would strike them as being funny, and they would laugh. And in that moment that they laughed is when their penis would start to work again. So another thing that I teach in my workshops is for people to learn how to bring humor back into the bedroom. You know, sometimes we take it a little too seriously. This is meant to be fun. So, you know, laughter is great medicine for what ails you when it comes to sex. Laughter frees up all your inhibitions and it gets you out of your head and into your body and it gets the blood flowing and it gets you to breathing. And these are all really, really good things for sexual function. So you can play games with yourself, you know. You can play games where you try to do the opposite of what you really want. So if you're afraid that you're going to ejaculate right away, you know, you could give yourself permission to do that. What's the worst that's going to happen? Again, if you don't think that you have to have an erect penis to have amazing sex, then let's say you do ejaculate sooner than you wanted to. Well, that's easy. You know, just get out that vibrator or use your hand or use your tongue. There's so many ways that you can achieve intimacy with another person and please that person sexually, and you certainly don't need an erect penis to do it. But if you're focused on that and you allow yourself to feel that disappointment and then start apologizing, yeah, you know, that's kind of interjecting a real mood killer. So, So what you want to do is just like go, oh, okay, you just keep it seamless. It's like, well, that's not working right now. Who cares? Let's move on to the next thing. So that's another thing that you can do is just give you yourself and your partner permission to be human. You know, don't always be, this is not a race. It's not a contest. And if it is, then that's pretty sad. Let's keep it fun. Let's keep it experimental. Let's go for ways in which you can get closer to the other person. And you know what? Would it really be such a bad thing if you are afraid, if you are nervous, to tell your partner? To just let them know, I'm afraid and I'm nervous. Sometimes what you'll find is, so is your partner. You know, most of us are. Really, really human to have these kind of emotions. And it's nothing to be ashamed of. So, premature ejaculation. First and foremost, I really recommend looking at how you feel about sex in general and how you're functioning when you masturbate. If you're able to sustain an erection and get to an orgasm in a reasonable amount of time when you masturbate, that is, you know, you don't touch yourself and just immediately go off, then you may find that you've got some emotional issues coming up in context of having sex with another person. Let's say you're not. Let's say you premature ejaculate when you masturbate. Some of the tips that you can work on are the squeeze technique. You can hold the base of your penis right at that moment where you feel like you're going to ejaculate too soon and squeeze real hard until that urge passes and then start stimulating yourself again. And in this way, you can kind of build your resistance up. The other thing you can do is practice PC muscle exercises so that you squeeze the set of muscles that allow you to stop and start the flow of urine. Those are your pubococcygeal muscles. We say PC for short. And if you learn to exercise those muscles, this is one test I love to, not test, but little game I like to give my male clients, which is hang a towel on your erect penis and try to wave the towel. So if you can do that, then you've got some pretty strong PC muscles, and you probably don't need to exercise them. But if you can't, that gives you something to shoot for. I'm sorry, I just can't seem to stop saying all those sexual jokes tonight. Okay, so anyway, practice your PC muscles. You can try the squeeze technique for premature ejaculation. And some of the other stuff you can do, these things, put a condom on it. If you're not using a condom, try a condom. You can even try masturbating with a condom on. If you find condoms dead in the sensation, masturbate with the condoms until you can learn how to feel through the condom. If you are having trouble with premature ejaculation, put a condom on in order to create a little bit of a deadening so that you can last longer. And so let's see. We got the condom. We've got the squeeze technique. We've got the PC exercises, squeezing your PC muscles, and we've got working on your emotional issues. There's more. There's more, but we're running out of time. So anyway, next time you tune in, I'm going to be finishing a little bit more of telling you the story of my life as an escort and how I became a certified sexologist. And then we'll be taking on the next question on here, which is how to enjoy cunnilingus. So thanks for tuning in, and I will see you here again next week. Good night.
Thank you for tuning in tonight. If you liked what you heard and you want more solutions for your love life, please call me toll-free at 888-903-0050. Once again, that number is 888-903-0050. I am the only person who answers that line, and I am usually available Monday through Friday from 10 a.m. to 10 p.m. Pacific Time. You can also visit sexwithoutshame.com to discover more of what I can do for you. And remember, your secret is safe with me.